Thank you, Paul. You know, some Bible stories are so familiar that we've sort of given them titles. And just the mention of a part of that title is all we need to complete the title in many cases. For instance, if I say to you, Noah and the... There you go. David and... You're getting them. Samson and... Here's one, I don't know if you'll get. Elijah under the tree. What kind of tree? It's a tree. Well, the King James Bible used to say juniper tree, and that's the way I learned it. But I think some translations say broom tree now. It has a different rendition now, and that's what's throwing you, I think. Anyway, Elijah under the tree. How about Jonah and the... All right, you got that. Moses crossing the... Yes. Joshua and the battle of... Daniel in the... There you go. Thank you, Bill, for reading Daniel chapter 6, because that's the story. And Daniel was not in the lion's den because of something he did wrong. He was in the lion's den because of something he did right. And what brought this on is maybe as significant as the lion's den experience itself. As we open the sixth chapter of the book of Daniel, and I'm not going to read it again because Bill just read it for us, we see there's a personage here called Darius the Mede, and we see that we have shifted empires. In our earlier class, we talked about the Babylonian Empire led by Nebuchadnezzar. Now, King Cyrus of the Persians has taken the power away from the Babylonians, and it is centered in the Medes and Persians. The Medes were the older kingdom, the Persians were the newer and yet more powerful kingdom. And Cyrus has taken over the city of Babylon. He did that on October the 12th, 539 BC, by coming in under the wall that I described in our earlier session. The Euphrates River had been channeled away up north. And so Cyrus went about 100 miles north of the city of Babylon and channeled the Euphrates River over into a swamp to make the water level lower to where his soldiers were able to march under the city wall of Babylon, that 87 feet, and get into the city of Babylon. And then the gates were opened and the city of Babylon was overrun by Persian soldiers, and the city of Babylon was taken, in essence, without a shot being fired, although many people were killed that night. But there really wasn't any battle because it was such a surprise. Belshazzar, as I've learned to call him from my brother on the back row, he often sits on the back row, Joe, he read it last time, and he said Belshazzar, and I think I like that way of pronouncing it better than Belshazzar. He was surprised by what happened that night when he saw the handwriting on the wall. So Darius the Mede now has been left in charge of the city of Babylon while Cyrus goes on to other conquests. And he is a subordinate official. Cyrus has placed him there. We see at the end of Daniel chapter 5, verses 31 and 32, that Darius is about 62 years of age. But he's ruling over an inferior kingdom, or Cyrus is, and Darius is a subordinate official. The Medo-Persian Empire is an inferior kingdom to the Babylonian Empire. This had been predicted when the image was seen in Daniel 2. Daniel 2, verse 39, calls the Medo-Persian Empire an inferior kingdom. So we've got a breakdown in governmental procedures here. Daniel is still there, kind of like Talleyrand at the time of the French Revolution. He's there no matter who's in charge. There's Talleyrand in the shadows influencing things. And Daniel is still here. Nations rise and nations fall, but this has little to do with the ongoing people of God. We're always there, often in the shadows, often unseen, often unrecorded by history, but God's people are always still there. So we see here in the beginning of chapter 6, immediately, an inferior form of government, probably the very most, in the short term, the very most effective and efficient form of civil government is a benevolent monarchy or a dictatorship led by somebody who has the best interest of the people at heart. Plato's philosopher king. In the Republic, Plato writes quite a lot about this. A philosopher king would be the best form of government. The trouble is that it seldom lasts for more than one generation, And then if it's a hereditary monarchy, you get the ne'er-do-well son of the king who makes everybody miserable. So that's why our founding fathers did not set up a monarchy, because they'd gotten sick of it over in Europe, and they knew well that that was not the way to set it up for a long term. But it works in the short term during the time of the benevolent monarch. Remember, sometimes we've talked about the sixth chapter of the book of Revelation, and if you take the continuous historical view of that, this was the era of the five good kings, I believe, in the first seal in Revelation chapter 6. The five good kings, starting with Nero, and then you had Trajan and Hadrian and Antoninus Pius and Marcus Aurelius, the five good kings, one after another, but they didn't have sons that could rule, and so they had to adopt the most capable man. And that's how they kept it going through five kings there instead of just one, because the principle of heredity was absent for a while. And they're known to history as the five good kings. That doesn't happen often enough for us to take a gamble with a monarchy, and that's why our founders spread the power out over three branches of government. Even though it's very messy and it takes a long time to do anything, at least no one person has too much power this way. So Darius had set up 120 satraps who shared the authority over the kingdom. And of course, as soon as authority is delegated, then you run the risk of corruption. And it seems that Darius feared this, so he set over those 120 satraps a second echelon who were closer in authority to him, three presidents or commissioners to guard against a ripoff. Those 120 lived all over the empire, and they could get a lot of illegal revenue if they weren't watched. So he set this second echelon there closer to himself, and these three were apparently the most trusted men in the kingdom. And Daniel is one of them. Daniel's in his 80s now, but he's not a retired desk-collecting rocking chair personality. Daniel is involved. He's got a lot of seniority. He's got a lot of superiority within the government. But you know, often in our world, it's not what you know, but it's who you know that may bring the promotion. Now, in God's world, it's different than that. In God's world, it's who you are, really, not who you know or who you're related to. Daniel distinguished himself because, we're told here, and Bill just read it, he had an extraordinary spirit. He had a surpassingly excellent attitude and great integrity in spite of everything that had happened to him. In the class this morning, I briefly mentioned that he'd been stolen from his home as a young boy, probably had been castrated. We never read about a wife for Daniel or Shadrach, Meshach, or Abednego, these three young Hebrew men that were with Daniel a lot of the time. Daniel had a lot to resent, and he could have had he chosen that way of life. He could have built a sham around his life, and he could have looked as if he had a good attitude when he really didn't and just waited for his moment. But no, Daniel is real. Daniel is as authentic as you can get. There's no jealousy in Daniel. He's not threatened by the people who are in power with him. He doesn't turn nasty or ugly to the ones with whom he shared power. Now, as you work shoulder to shoulder on your job with the people in your shop or your office or your school or your sales force or wherever you are, attitude is such an important thing. Sometimes people think, will my superior notice if I have a good attitude? I wouldn't worry about that. Just have a good attitude anyway. And often the trouble doesn't come from your superior. Often the trouble comes from your fellow workers. Sometimes if your fellow workers are lazy or indolent, they'd like you better if you were too. Sometimes because you won't be like they are, they become envious or jealous and you're making them look bad and they try to neutralize you or your influence. And what happened to Daniel could happen to you under those sorts of circumstances. In verse 4, Daniel's peers and his underlings are attempting to find an accusation that they can bring against Daniel to neutralize him or to eradicate his good influence regarding government affairs. They're looking for some skeleton in Daniel's closet. And they made such a meticulous search that I'm sure if there had been anything to find, they would have definitely found it. They were hounded by envy. Now, when you think about this, you just wonder, knowing everything we know about Daniel, he seems like such a nice man to know. How could anybody not like Daniel? But then again, how could anybody crucify Jesus, the purest of the pure? But they did it anyway. I think it has something to do with Jesus and Daniel making other people look bad. It makes them feel bad that here's this superior creature, and I should be more like that person. I know I should, but I'm going to bring them down to make myself feel better. They didn't find any evidence of negligence or corruption on the part of Daniel. And we can each ask ourselves, how would I like for my work to come under that kind of scrutiny? Would I have to burn evidence? Would I have to hide evidence? Daniel was faithful in his work. That's another mark of integrity. And in government, believe me, it's not all that common. And I know that idea is not a hard sell. In government in particular, it seems, a purity is not all that common. There was a statement made in the book of Proverbs, chapter 20, verse 6. Most men will proclaim their own goodness, but a faithful man who can find? A faithful man is rare. So here's another mark of Daniel's integrity. He had a personal purity. They sent the FBI to trail him. They sent the CIA to search out his life. And they found neither negligence, something that should have been done that wasn't, nor did they find corruption, something that should not have been done that was. So their only avenue now is to go, in verse 5, and make an appeal to the vanity of the king. The Medo-Persian kings were deemed to be gods. And this is an appeal to the vanity that comes with that. They say, we've got, in verses 6 and 7, they say, we've got all the presidents and the princes, all the satraps. They come before the king, except Daniel is not there. And they make this statement, all the presidents of the kingdom, the governors, the princes, the counselors, the captains, have consulted together. Well, that's not true. It's a lie. Will Durant said in his book on the times of Martin Luther, he said, men lie most when they govern states. And we've seen this to be true throughout our lives. People lie the most when they're in governmental positions. So it shouldn't be any surprise. They're coming to the king with a lie. If he's a god, he should know it's a lie, but he's not really a god. He just thinks he's a god, and people treat him as if he's a god. And they come and they say, all the people who are in charge are unanimous. Everybody in the government is unanimous on this. That's a lie because it's all but one. Not all the presidents, all but one. Daniel doesn't even seem to even know anything about this. So the idea is that they make this firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, except you, O you God King, then he will be cast into a den of lions. Back in chapter 3, when the three Hebrew children got in trouble, they were going to be thrown into a fiery furnace. But the empire has changed now. They don't want to throw Daniel into a fiery furnace because the Persians are Zoroastrians and fire was sacred to them. If they cremated him, they would have made a god out of him. So instead of doing that, excuse me, they're going to cast him into a burning fiery furnace. Be glad you weren't close to that. And there was a proverbial statement that was made about the laws of the Medes and the Persians that they are unalterable because they're given by a god. If a god makes a statement, it doesn't need to be changed. And so it's as unalterable as the law of the Medes and the Persians. It is irrevocable once Darius states it and signs it into law. Darius, because of his vanity, thinks this is going to be a great idea. And Daniel has a conspiracy against him. Simply because he has done right. Simply because he has done a better job than anybody else. In verse 10, we see a remarkable response to a death warrant on the part of Daniel. When Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went to his home, his windows being open, in his chamber toward Jerusalem. He kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as he did before, as he did at other times. This is another mark of integrity, a consistent walk with God. Daniel did not just turn to prayer in times of panic. Daniel had been praying consistently long before this time. That's how they knew they could get him with this, because they knew what his pattern was. He prayed, and he prayed toward Jerusalem as Solomon had indicated should be done back when he dedicated the temple in 1 Kings chapter 8. 1 Kings 8 verse 30, Solomon talked about praying toward Jerusalem. Wherever a Jew is, pray toward Jerusalem. It was said in the Psalms, Psalm 55 verse 17, evening and morning and noon, I will pray and cry aloud, and he will hear my cry. So Daniel is praying evening and morning and noon, three times a day. Daniel's windows were already open. He doesn't just go home and slam them open so everybody can hear, I'm going to defy this law. No, he doesn't necessarily want to even be seen defying the law, but he's not hiding either. He's just going about his normal routine, which apparently everybody knew about. They all would know he was praying, but not because he is advertising it, just because he's doing it. Daniel's just amazing to me. I think if you'd have taken an electrocardiogram of Daniel at this time, that it would have just showed a normal pulse, same as always. As if they've made this decree, it's meant to get me, but what else is new? What else do you expect from the world? If we expect this kind of treatment from the world, then we won't be surprised by it. Daniel kneels in prayer. Maybe kneeling is a good way to pray sometimes because it can be a little bit uncomfortable. It can get our attention and help us to focus on what we're really saying and who we're really praying to. It can remind us when we kneel that God is still on his throne and man is still on God's footstool and there's only a knee's distance in between. Therefore, we can go boldly to the throne of grace. And don't say you're too busy to do this. I doubt that there's anybody here who's any busier than Daniel must have been. But he hewed out the time and took the time to pray, in his case, three times a day. Well, when the upshot of all this was, when they bring this charge now against Daniel, well, he asked a petition of God, and you've, King, oh, King, you've, Darius, you have made a decree that can't be altered, that he now needs to be put into the den of lions. When Darius finally figures this out, he must have been abnormally stupid to sign this law in the first place. He was, we see in verses 11 through 14, the King James says he was sore displeased with himself. Well, he sure should have been. This is, what a ridiculous law to sign in the first place. He has acted so foolishly, and he's the last one in the kingdom probably to catch on to how stupid this is. But even if you're a god, you've got to keep your word. So now Darius is in the position where he has to authorize the throwing of Daniel into this lion's den, even though he doesn't want to. He's stuck because of his own pride. You know, you seldom get what you deserve from people. So don't even expect it. Do you deserve honor, but you get criticism? Don't be surprised by that. You know, you may get confrontations in your life, but not get them at the times that you really need them. It often comes at the wrong time and in a wrong way. We need to grow from that if we can, but don't be surprised if people don't give you what you really deserve. Conversely from that, you will always get what is best from God, whether you realize it or not. It may not come in the package you expect. It may be delivered late according to your timetable. Some people expect God to instantly reward them, which he usually does not. Think of Elijah in his time. Elijah was brave and courageous in confronting the king, and he got hidden, but his brook dried up. How must Elijah have felt when his brook dried up? After he'd made the most courageous move of his life, very difficult for Elijah to do, he gets out there in safety and peace, but then his brook dries up. But looking back, Elijah could see how perfect God's plan was all the way through. Your ability to handle either criticism or honor is directly related to the consistency of your personal walk with God that other people don't necessarily know too much about. You can't handle the honors or the tests of adversity if your Christian walk is inconsistent. So I find myself strangely warmed by Daniel and the thought of him when I remember especially that he was in his 80s now. He's already lived a long, full, godly life, and he's being treated like an animal here when he's past his prime. Actually, this is Daniel's last great test, so far as we know. before he gives us the prophetic portion of the book. This is the last thing recorded. Then in chapter 7, we're immediately into all kinds of symbols and signs. A den full of carnivorous felines. Just imagine that. You've been to zoos. You've seen these big cats. And when you just look at the size of the paws on those animals, it's amazing to think about the immensity and the power of the king of beasts, or a tiger, or a leopard, or a jaguar. It's just stunning how much different they are from a house cat. They're built similarly, but they're just enormous. Just look at the face. Look at the breadth of the nose of one of these big cats. And think of facing them close up, and there's nothing between you and them. I see parallels here between the book of 1 Peter and what Daniel is facing. Those of you familiar with the book of 1 Peter know that every chapter in 1 Peter is about suffering. The theme is suffering. And in 1 Peter chapter 2 in particular, there's a lot that just reads like what we have read here in Daniel chapter 6. 1 Peter 2 verse 13. Submit yourselves unto every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake. That's what Daniel did. He submits. He's willing to pay the price to keep on praying to his God. No, nobody's going to stop him from praying to God. He knows what people are trying to do, but he's willing to pay the price. He's not hiding what he's doing, nor is he advertising it. He's just doing it in the same way that he has always done it. So he meets that criterion that Peter gives us. Submit yourselves unto every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake. In Daniel 6:3, we see that he had a link of friendship with the king. And by the end of this chapter, it seems as if Darius' heart is turned or turning in the way of Jehovah. 1 Peter 2:15, for so is the will of God, that with well-doing you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. Daniel 6:4, one of the few major characters of Scripture of whom there is nothing bad recorded. Of course he sinned, Romans 3:23, but we just don't have any sins for Daniel recorded. So he, in this chapter, is going to put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. Again, a little further in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 18 and 19. Servants, be subject to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle masters, but also to the froward, the wicked, the crooked, the perverse. For this is thankworthy, if a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffering wrongfully. Chapter 6, verse 10 of Daniel, all he did was pray, and yet he endured grief over this. Again, in 1 Peter 2, verse 20, what glory is it if, when you be buffeted for your faults, you shall take it patiently? But if, when you do well and suffer for it, you take it patiently, this is acceptable with God. And this is the territory into which Daniel has now gone. When you've done right and you're mistreated, stand patiently under that test. That's really the whole point of Daniel 6. When we read the book of Jonah, we might have a temptation to highlight the fish. Here in Daniel 6, we might be tempted to highlight Daniel or to highlight the lions. But God is working on Darius here. Daniel is a conduit. Daniel is not the main point. God is working on Darius, the king. And God is working through Daniel toward an end. When these things go on, you might be a seemingly insignificant part of the whole arrangement, and still your part be important. And that's what happens here. The king is tricked into carrying out his own decree. And then in chapter 6, verse 16, he talks about Daniel's God. And I think that's a significant thing in the 16th verse. Then the king commanded, and they brought Daniel in and cast him into the den of lions. Now the king spoke and said unto Daniel, thy God, whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee. How did Darius know about Daniel's God? I'll just give you one guess. He had been mentioned by Daniel repeatedly, because that's the way Daniel was. Daniel talked about his God to Nebuchadnezzar. Now Nebuchadnezzar and his old empire is gone. Daniel's talking to his immediate superior, King Darius, in another empire, but he's still talking about the same one true and living God. Daniel and this king have developed a friendship, just like he had a friendship with Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel now has a friendship with Darius. And Darius, This is important. Darius, without feeling threatened and without feeling preached at and without feeling put down, has come to see something real in the life of this prophet. Daniel had a knack for that. Nebuchadnezzar had the same experience. So the king here encourages Daniel. And of course, that's pretty easy to do if it's the other guy going into the lion's den. Easy to encourage you. Oh, you'll be all right. You can do it. Your God will see you through. If I'd have been Daniel, there might have been claw marks for me on the arm of Nebuchadnezzar as I'm getting thrown into the lion's den, trying to hold on from him to keep from getting thrown in. You know, they found a den in Morocco a number of years ago that might have been similar to this one. It was a large square cavern under the earth. It had a partition wall in the middle of it and a door in the wall, which the keeper could open and close from above like a dungeon. And by throwing food in on one side, they would entice the lions from one chamber to the other, and then shutting the door in the partition, they could enter into the vacant space to clean it out, which you would need to do. This cavern that they found was open above, and its top was covered by a large flat stone that was placed over the den and just propped up slightly so that free air could move underneath the stone for ventilation. This lion's den in Daniel 6 sounds very much like this one that we had found. Well, the upshot of this all was that King Darius passed a terrible night. He couldn't enjoy any entertainment or music. He just anxiously awaited until dawn, and as soon as there's enough light to see, he gets out there, and he's holding his breath in verses 19 and 20, waiting for some sign of life out of that lion's den besides a roar. And he gets over there and has a conversation with Daniel while Daniel is still down in that den. If I was Daniel, I would have wanted to get out of the den first and then have the conversation. But Daniel has the conversation while he's still in the den. He has this talk and apparently has no fear. It may be that you have to go through something like this to really enter into the spiritual message of it. But some of you have already gone through some pretty tough stuff in your lives. Even in the middle of this experience, Daniel talks about it as if it's already over. I like that. There's no panic in Daniel because he has such tremendous trust in God. And then when he does come out, Daniel does not ask the king to retaliate against his enemies. Can you imagine that? He doesn't ask for any retaliation at all. Daniel's conscience is so pure, he has no bitterness toward those who have put him there. Well, a critic might say that the reason Daniel didn't get eaten by those lions is because the lions weren't hungry. But verse 24 is proof that it was God who had stopped the lions' mouths, because the guys that put Daniel in the lion's den then are thrown in there, and before they even reach the floor, they're already food. These big cats are eating machines. That's the way God built them, to devour much flesh. And they do that in this case. So Darius then issues another decree that makes a lot more sense. And we've got down in verse 28, as for me, Daniel, so this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Cyrus was really over the empire, but Darius had been placed over the city of Babylon in a kind of a co-regency. Long before, God had made decrees about what was going to happen to his people. And now that Darius makes this decree about the one true and living God, the people of Judea, before very much time has gone by, are going to be allowed to go back to the promised land. Cyrus is going to send them back. And that happens just shortly here. I would like to believe, and I have reason to believe, that it was the example of Daniel that softened the heart of King Cyrus toward the Jews. Tradition says, and this is Jewish tradition, it's not scripture, but tradition says that Daniel showed Cyrus what we call the 44th and 45th chapters of the book of Isaiah, how God had predicted Cyrus by name 140 years before his birth, and had called Cyrus my shepherd and my anointed one, and told of the things that Cyrus would do. Can you imagine being the king of an empire, and this prophet comes in and shows you from these ancient scriptures that your name is in there, and it's predicted you would do certain things? I think you would be, just on that basis, you would be amenable to going ahead and fulfilling that prophecy. And that's what Cyrus did. He sent the Jews back, 42,360 of them, went back to rebuild the temple of God. And this is well known to you from your study of the Old Testament. In concluding, I just want to say, wouldn't it be something if we could see things like God sees them for a day? Just for one day. Just back away from our lives and get that whole perspective of how God views things. Because in God's providence, He uses one person in one area as a relay to another person who in turn touches the life of another person, and from that it rebounds maybe to a fourth person, and we don't even know what's going on, but God is behind all of this. Lives are changed three or four links away from the original action, and you never knew it and you never would know it from your own human perspective. Maybe it's true that, as the old song says, every day you see one more card, but you'll never see them all in this world. And God is working amazing things in His inscrutable plan. As this plan unfolds, the pieces of the puzzle fall into place, sometimes where even we can see them. Romans 11:33. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. How unsearchable His judgments. How inscrutable His way. If you're outside of Christ today and are here and would come to Him in simple trusting faith, there may be a real providential reason that you're here this very day. If you would come to Him in primary obedience, or if you have anything else to bring before the assembled church this morning, we want you to take advantage of this opportunity and invitation by coming up to one of these front seats and letting us know what we can do for you. As we stand together, Paul's going to lead one more song.